You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton.
Tuition at Murray State will increase by 4% for the next academic year. The increase amounts to around $130 per semester. The MSU Board of Regents voted against the administration's 3% recommendation. The board consensus was the revenue from the additional percentage point would lessen the impact on the university's reserves. With the additional tuition revenue, MSU will still need to fill an estimated $2.4 million gap with reserves. The Kentucky Council on Postsecondary Education has capped tuition increases for schools like Murray State at 5%. Typically, MSU's board has voted to increase tuition at the maximum amount capped by the CPE. Dr. Dunn and I spoke prior to Friday's meeting and discussed his 3% recommendation. We'll now begin our monthly chat with Dr. Dunn, explaining the reasoning for going in below the CPE cap.
Well, I guess from my standpoint, there were a number of things that caused me to look in that regard. One of which is that we just cannot keep doing, and our board has acknowledged this too, we just can't keep doing over and over what has been this pattern that's been created, not just in Kentucky, but across the country, where you have a loss of state support. Some years it's fairly large, like it is for us this year. Some years it may be a buzz cut of 1 or 2%. But we've seen this decline in state support over many years, and particularly since I've been here now 5.5, going on 6 years in Kentucky, that same trend taking place. To just continually go to tuition to get that made back is creating an untenable situation. Now, our pricing is low enough. We have some flexibility. If we were at the high end of the price scale, it would probably be compounded even more. We're not. We're among the lowest priced institutions in Kentucky. Usually Kentucky State and Murray State are tied for the least expensive pricing. That is the case presently. But even with that, this continual notion that as the state support is lost, we're just going to keep going back to tuition and get it recovered is not something that can be sustained over time. And at some point, some institution has to, you know, say, in our case, time out racers, let's think about this, and we're going to do that. Our board, as I alluded to, has also carried this value for a long time. We've had this discussion literally every year I've been at the institution when it came time to set tuition. All of the members who we've had serve on Murray State boards have held to this value that they want the pricing low. They want quality high, but they want also a tremendous value that the university provides, and they've also been saying, really, each year as we've considered tuition, we just can't keep climbing it at these rates that every year put more and more squeeze on the families who traditionally send their students to Murray State, and they've been pretty strong about this notion as well. So I think it's the year to really show that we do believe in that, and that we're willing to try to do things on our end to make that lower tuition increase work, even in an environment where we're losing state support. There are some other things that go into play here as well, and if you want to explore those, I'm glad to, with regard to pricing and whatnot. One factor that comes into play, of course, is salaries and education, particularly higher education, is a human capital enterprise. 70 to 80% of our budget goes for salaries of faculty and staff. We gave a very healthy increase a year ago. Our employees had a 4% raise across the board coming into this present 2011-12 school year. Well, that was very healthy. Most of our other institutions didn't do an increase at that level. And I do think that portends for us the fact that we would not be looking at raises for our employees for 12-13. Not that they don't deserve them. They all work very hard. Although other things we've committed to, obviously, will be paid. Promotions that people earn. We've been working on a 3-year implementation to bring our hourly paid staff salaries to market level. We're going to continue the 3rd year of that implementation, where job audits take place, obviously, and a new pay grade is assigned. We're going to support that. Nothing's going away in that regard, and we'll probably have somewhere in the vicinity of 20 to 25% of our employees who will see their salaries increase on some basis around that. But an across-the-board increase, I don't envision. If the board decides they want to do that, and we have modeled some budget scenarios for them around this, but that's got to be their call. If they hold fast on salaries for a year, which ultimately is a board decision, then I think we can make it work. We've really built the budget around this lower number in anticipation of something we thought would happen, but we know now is not taking place, and that was the potential for a student fee to be applied, to be used to fund a new library facility. As we've been looking at this over the past 18 months or so, we knew that if it was the case that a student fee went on for a library, that would equate to roughly 2 or 3% of a tuition increase, shall we say. It would have been a fee, but it would have equated to about that amount of money. On that basis, we knew internally that we were going to be looking at a very, very low tuition increase for this coming year in the hopes that then combined with a fee, it would have given us a rate increase about what everybody else is doing. Well, the board has indicated we're not going to pursue a library on a fee basis, so that frees up that equated percentage of tuition, if you will. But since we had made the plans and really had created a structure to be able to live with a low level of increase for next year, I don't feel that we should rush out and add 2 or 3% on just because now we're not going to have a student fee. Another thing that's true is the fact that we'll use next year to look at some increased efficiencies, reallocation of funding, just looking at a whole package of changes to our financial model that could be made. And once we take that on, that will give us a roadmap to stabilize our funding to some degree. We don't know where that's going to go. We don't know the changes to be made from that, obviously, until we get into that work during the next fiscal year. Again, I just think there's kind of a moral imperative not to go to the students and say, oh, go ahead and give us that 2 or 3 extra percent in tuition without us going through that process.
Do you think Murray State's ahead of this reorganization of how you manage your finances within the Commonwealth, or do you think other universities in Kentucky are doing the same thing?
Everybody has to be in this game. Some have done a few bits and pieces of it, maybe not in as comprehensive a fashion. Others are going to be getting into the work in some way. Everybody kind of figures out how to do this on their own campus. Some institutions, a couple of our public colleagues made very quick decisions, almost reflexive when we got the announcement about the 6.4% cut for next year when that was made with the governor's budget announcement in January. But everyone is going to be doing this work in whatever way, in some form or fashion, because they're not going to be able to sustain the business plan or the business model that they've had out without doing that study.
It's close to commencement. A lot of Murray State students will be entering the job market. And let's talk about that job market for Murray State students. Is MSU doing anything differently to prepare our graduates for employment?
Well, I think we're trying to take a more comprehensive approach that really almost every college and university is looking at now. Part of the responsibility the university has, I feel, is to help our graduates find positions. You know, we can't go out there and necessarily write the letter for them and what have you. But we do want to look at everything that we can do for their success, because the impact that a Murray State graduate has on the world comes usually from the fact that they get jobs and they go make their way and have success in career that can lead to success in life and influence and impact and all of those good things you want from a person with a university education. So career services folks have looked to beef up the job fairs that they're doing, increase the offerings as far as training and background in a number of our courses. And that's, you know, part of their work, but they've taken a new approach to try to reinvigorate that process, particularly around the job fairs that they sponsor for our students. You have a number of courses, particularly capstone courses in various disciplines, and I teach one of these now in nonprofit leadership. We've talked about that before. And I actually have done a unit, and others do this in other fields. I do a unit in my course, which is essentially a career preparation unit. And we look at how they present themselves and professionalism in interviewing and how to conduct yourself in those processes that lead ultimately to a successful and well-paying job. There are probably things beyond that that we should look at. In fact, Gina Winchester, who's our executive director for regional outreach, and I have had some discussion about this. One of the goals that we have for our outreach efforts is economic development and job creation. We undertake sponsorship of various projects. We work with our area development districts and things of that nature. But we're thinking there's probably something we could capture within that area that could be helpful, maybe in a more indirect way, in building jobs in the area and supporting those, all of which could be helpful for our graduates. You know, I think in some ways we're doing what a lot of schools are doing to try to beef up our services to students in that field. But I will tell you, the best thing that we can do for Murray State students is ensure that we're keeping the strength of the degree, that the Murray State brand remains strong and is recognized as a quality degree, not just within Kentucky or the region, but wherever they would go nationally, that we have opportunities within our programs, and I think particularly here about internships and short placements, pre-career, that students have an opportunity to avail themselves of just in almost every discipline we teach, certainly all the professional disciplines. And while we want to look at the direct services that are important to them, there's a whole benefit that also comes from ensuring that the degree they come out of here with prepares them for success, and we believe it does. And that's probably the biggest thing we can do to help our graduates.
Does Murray State keep any statistics of placement rates?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, but now don't ask me to quote those because I didn't look them up before we, you know, record this today. But we do follow up. In fact, as part of our accreditation, which is you and some of our listeners remember, we're in the middle of right now. We're in the thick of preparing our re-accreditation case. And as part of that, have to look at follow-up with our graduates at various time levels. So we do have that, and generally they fall in line very well with what while I can't quote you exact numbers, I don't want to do that for fear of being wrong. I can tell you that our placement numbers, the percentages, are very much in league, just as good as any of the other state schools. In fact, better, as I recall, that we would kind of typically see as our competition.
Let's move on and talk about one of your bosses. The Murray State students reelected one of your bosses,
right?
Student Regent Jeremiah Johnson.
Right.
How does he play into the board dynamic?
Well, I think Jeremiah, really like every student regent I've seen here at Murray State University, is very much a part of the board dynamic. As I, you know, referenced in the earlier segment, I've had a lot of board members come through here at Murray State in my 5.5 or so years. I'm really down, and I think I've mentioned this before, I'm down to one of my original hiring board members in really kind of a relatively short period of time. Well, I've seen this be the case with all of the boards I've worked with here. The student regent is folded in and certainly made to feel like and be, which he or she is, a full functioning member of the board with all rights and privileges thereto appertaining. Certainly not seen as an add-on or included, really on an ad hoc basis, depending on the issue. I think it's been the case with Jeremiah, has been with other student regents, SGA presidents, that they are part and parcel of the board's work, deliberations, decision-making, conscience, everything that goes into the dynamics of a board at this level.
Around 10% of students cast ballots in the SGA election. And for you, for this being a member of the board, are you happy with the 10% turnout?
For the student region being a member of the board, yes. I thought you were saying I'm a member of the board.
No.
Such it could be. You know, that's actually something in private institutions – is fairly typical, but not at Publix. Back to your question. Yeah. I am bothered by that. I mean, to sit here and try to say otherwise would be silly of me. A 10% rate of voting, particularly when considered in conjunction with the high stakes of the vote. I just got through talking about the fact that this is a big deal. SGA president at a public Kentucky institution sits as a voting member of the board, et cetera, all those things I was mentioning. And then to see that low turnout rate is disappointing to me. I think it's something that SGA as a whole, those who we employ at the university to work with student government, need to be looking at and thinking about. I don't think it's particularly a point of pride. And I would commend them to maybe look at ways that could be strengthened over time. Of course, you look at public voting rates, and that's pretty dismaying as well, isn't it? And maybe that's reflective of, you know, what we have happening at the universities. We're not that far out of line with what other schools are seeing, by the way.
But it's interesting, when we interview folks that are specialists in elections, they say the reason that the election or that the turnout rate, voter turnout rate in the U.S. is low is because there are so many elections. But if you look at an SGA election, it's annual.
Right. And there's certainly some ceremony around it as the announcement takes place in conjunction with all campusing and, you know, that type of deal. I don't know that this is the case, but one of the phenomena that I think we're experiencing here may be, and I haven't studied it, haven't looked at it, don't know. But again, as I think about it, it's probably worth some investigation, is that student elections may be strongly driven by the Greek community, that candidates who get in may have backing from fraternities or sororities. They tend to come out in response to candidates. And I'm not talking about any one election. I'm looking at this kind of collectively. But we've got about 10% turnout of student voters. About 10% of our student body is Greek. Again, I don't know who votes and who doesn't. But I have this kind of general sense that it's maybe been kind of deferred off to the Greek system, that they're going to be the ones, you know, in the campaigns, you know, working student voting and all of that type of thing. And I hope we can expand beyond that, that we can look at ways to involve the campus student body in larger fashion. So it's not just something that, oh, yeah, the Greeks put up their candidates and you know, run the campaigns and somebody gets elected. Again, at this point, that's only theoretical. I don't know. But what I do know is that there are a number of folks that should be concerned about this, and over time, I hope, you know, those groups can take it on and look at it. Now, you know, a president can't fix everything. I don't look at this as something that I've got to go out and solve necessarily. This has to be something that emerges from the body impacted. But I do hope there are things that could be looked at to address this, and if there's some role I can play, I'm sure glad to do it. That, you know, they do this in a great way. The voting's online. There's a nice window to get it accomplished. The campaign is pretty well structured, doesn't drag on forever, and pretty well managed in terms of the rules. And there's a focus on it at this point in the spring semester. So something's not clicking, and hopefully over time we can maybe figure that out.
Well, Dr. Dunn, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Chad.
Next on Front Page Sunday, we round out Poetry Month with Shakespeare and middle schoolers. We'll find out more coming up. This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. As National Poetry Month closes, we're bringing you a glimpse into Murray Middle School classroom activities with the Shakespeare in the Schools Partnership Initiative. It coordinates with the annual Shakespeare Festival in Murray. Murray State faculty member Dr. Barbara Cobb brought the Bard's Sonnets to Murray Middle and shares a sample of student responses with Kate Lochte.
Barbara, you did a fairly major poetry project with Murray Middle School students. Set it up for us like you did for the students.
Okay, the fourth graders that I'm working with at Murray Middle School were coming out of a unit where they had read a book called Crispin, which takes place in the medieval period. And their teacher then brought them in to a project making commonplace books. They did a woodcut type of project, printed it on the front of their books. And then we brought them in to do a unit reading a number of Shakespeare sonnets and then writing sonnets that are inspired by the Shakespeare sonnets. The first sonnet that we work with is Shakespeare's Sonnet 18. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Now let's take a listen to what Cooper, one of our fourth graders, has done with this inspiration.
Shall I compare donuts to the Indiana Pacers? Donuts are better. The Pacers haven't really won. Donuts are a lot of fun. NBA is not fun to watch all night. Donuts are, they have much delight. Going to a Pacers game is overpriced, but donuts are lowly priced. Though Pacers spirit is here every day, and the nearest donut shop is far away. Basketball is fun, but kind of dressy. Donuts, I say, are very, very messy. The Pacers might now be the best. The best everywhere, not just the East or the West. But I've changed my mind. Donuts are better.
Barbara, that just made me laugh when I heard it the first time. It made me happy.
Oh, yes, it makes me very happy, too. And the way he turns it at the end to donuts. Yeah, but the rhyme, the way he picked up on the way that the rhyme works is just so extraordinary, really a wonderful example of how these poems can inspire our young writers.
What's next?
What's next is Sonnet 29. When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries and look upon myself and curse my fate. This one, we're going to listen to McKenna, another one of our fourth graders, working from this poem.
One day I was riding my horse and I felt like there was rapid wind all around me. My horse took off. I couldn't control him. I kept slipping and slipping. I fell right into a metal fence. I could feel my horse run right by me. It was painful. Sometimes I can still feel the pain haunting me.
Now, Barbara, that strikes me as a much older person than a fourth grader.
The emotion that she is able to convey there, that last phrase, haunting me, I have to admit, it haunts me. Very, very clever. Yeah.
And it captures the sonnets.
Well, the first part of 29, before it gets to its turn, is talking about that deep emotion that is when we feel that feeling of dread, that feeling of not being able to move beyond the things that are weighing on us. And we've got a fourth grader who is expressing those things that weigh on us and that we just can't seem to push away so that we can get back to our happy spot.
Yeah. Yeah. And next?
One of the other sonnets we work with is Sonnet 130, and that's my mistress's eyes are nothing like the sun. Coral is far more red than her lips red. The one that ends, and yet by heaven, I think my love is rare as any she belied with false compare. This one we do a Mad Libs with, and I wish I had one of the Mad Libs for you. They're hilariously funny.
But what's a Mad Lib?
Oh, a Mad Libs where we take out certain words from it, and then you don't know, you know, and I just say, I need a plural noun, and we fill in any plural noun. And they wrote really hilarious ones with that. But the one that I brought is one by one of our fourth graders named Garrett. And I think it really demonstrates what they can do with a poem of this type.
My dog's behavior is nothing like a show dog. Velvet is far more soft than his claws. If snow be white, then his teeth are yellow. If fur be smooth, then forest tree roots grow on its back. I've seen happy tails, wagging tails, and curly tails, but I see no happy, wagging, nor curly tails on him. And in some toys, there are more delight than when you throw a ball and tell him to chase it. I love to hear him bark, yet well I know that music has a far more pleasing sound. I grant I never saw a show dog heel. My dog pulls on the leash, and yet I love him.
Again, I had to laugh because my dogs are nothing like show dogs.
Well, you know, Kate, it's clear from this poem that Garrett understands Shakespeare's sonnet. And what I see over and again with this unit is that fourth graders can read Shakespeare.
Our thanks to Dr. Barbara Cobb and Murray Middle School fourth graders Cooper, McKenna, and Garrett for reminding us of the sonnets in the sampling from a project of the Shakespeare in the Schools Partnership Initiative, which coordinates with the Murray Shakespeare Festival.
The girls today in society go for classical poetry. So to win their hearts, one must quote with ease Aeschylus and Euripides. But the poet of them all, who will start 'em simply raving, is the poet people call the Bard of Stratford-on-Avon. Brush up your Shakespeare, start quoting him now. Brush up your Shakespeare.
The American Quilter Society annual show in Paducah has just wrapped up, and quilters who attended saw nearly every fabric, design, and stitch associated with the art of quilting. Yet as the 150th anniversary of the Civil War continues, Casey Northcutt investigates a time when fabric was scarce and the quilts were relief supplies sent to soldiers. Of those quilts women did manage to piece together, only a portion remains today, serving as a testament to the hardships of the time.
In one of Gone with the Wind's most famous scenes, the once affluent Scarlett O'Hara finds herself destitute after the Civil War. To pay taxes on her home, she must borrow $300 from the still wealthy Rhett Butler, but she has no proper clothing left in which to see him. Undaunted, Scarlett O'Hara sews her drapes into a dress.
Rhett!
Scarlett, my dear little sister.
O'Hara's predicament vividly portrays one of the hardships people faced from 1861 to 1865, when the Union and Confederate armies faced off in the country's deadliest war. Necessities such as fabric became ever scarce, especially in the South, and people sacrificed prized possessions to make clothing and eventually quilts.
A lot of times the most beautiful fabrics that were available would be fabrics that were used for draperies or home decor, or just the scraps would be used for quilts.
Justin Hancock speaks from the fabric warehouse in Hancock's of Paducah, his family's business. He has watched customer after customer purchase kits designed to recreate historical quilt patterns, including those designed to reflect Civil War fabrics and styles. As the war's sesquicentennial anniversary progresses, fabric manufacturers have started playing even more to their customers' historical fascinations.
I think people have a deep-seated interest in connecting to the past. In our industry, a lot of things are very fashionable, and yet they're reproductions of things that have been done before or reinterpretations of art that is neoclassical or Art Nouveau or arts and crafts. And so this connection to the past through textiles is pretty strong.
Unfortunately, Hancock's might be the easiest way to find quilt samples from that period. A lot of the original pieces have not survived the 150 years since their creation. Quilt historian and author Barbara Brockman says people quilted during the Civil War, but overuse, disease contamination, and harsh environments destroyed a lot of the pieces. What quilts we do have serve as history books written with material and stitches. Brockman says women of aid societies generated many of the quilts during that period and sent them to soldiers in battle.
And that's why quilts are important, because they often document women's lives, and some of these were women's organizations. And they document women's lives in ways that newspapers, formal things sometimes didn't.
Along with preserving history, quilts from the Civil War also preserve stories. Brockman says numerous pieces possess backstories in which soldiers stole them from the enemy army. At the same time, several quilts possess backstories that are complete myth. Remember that tale about slaves using quilts as code on the Underground Railroad? Not true. Brockman says stories circulate that slaves once used patterns such as the Drunkard's Path to communicate secret messages. The Drunkard's Path supposedly indicated that escapees should run in zigzags to avoid capture. However, that pattern did not develop until the 1880s.
These are like anachronisms. These are like having a person wear a wristwatch in a movie about the Civil War. You know, it's just so wrong.
But surrounded in historical fact or intriguing myth, these quilts have an enigmatic tie to history. In an upstairs corner of the Market House Museum in Paducah, a glass case houses a quilt stitched by Mary Anna Custis Lee, the wife of General Robert E. Lee. Lee quilted the piece shortly after the Civil War ended, but her creation holds a distinct tie to that era. She used patches of blue cut from Confederate uniform material. Executive Director Penny Bockham Fields can visualize the woman hunched over her quilt, stitching with hands that, by that time, were gnarled from arthritis.
It's just unbelievable. Somebody who had that much pain in their hands, you would think probably when they did a quilt pattern, they would do a very easy quilt pattern. This is not. You can see all the little stitches. I mean, it's about the size of oyster crackers.
Its bright red sections have faded to a dusty pink. It's hard to imagine such an influential woman sewing that very quilt, but it's even harder to imagine the circumstances she endured. Lee stitched through pain, like every other woman who quilted through the Civil War. For WKMS News, I'm Casey Northcutt.
When we come back, we'll look at another piece of fabric with Civil War roots. The Confederate battle flag stirs controversy whenever it's displayed and promises to generate more when it flies over a McCracken County park. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Earlier this month, the Sons of Confederate Veterans announced plans for a park to be built on private land just off Exit 16 on I-24 in McCracken County. It's intended as a memorial to the area's Confederate soldiers. And at the center of the park and an emerging controversy is a flagpole, upon which will fly the Red Field, Blue Cross, and 13 white stars of the Confederate battle flag. The flag has been a lightning rod for controversy for years. The SCV insists it's a symbol of heritage, while opponents see it as an emblem of racism. For some perspective, I spoke with John Koski, a vexillologist, that's someone who studies flags, and a historian at the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia. He's also the author of The Confederate Battle Flag, America's Embattled Emblem, which details the flag's history and how it came to represent different things to different people.
People don't seem to get upset by the Stars and Bars, the first national flag. As a matter of fact, the Stars and Bars flies over Confederate graves at Shiloh National Battlefield. What is it about the Confederate battle flag that tends to get some people up in arms?
It is interesting that the Stars and Bars, and I'm so pleased that you're using Stars and Bars correctly for the first national flag rather than, as so many people do, as a name for the battle flag, the blue cross on the red field, of course, the battle flag that we're talking about. And as someone observed when I first started working on this subject 20 years ago, if there's one flag that people today ought to object to of Confederate flags, it should be the Stars and Bars, because that was the first flag of the nation of the Confederacy, of the seven original Deep South Confederate states, whose secession was pretty clearly based on defense of slavery from perceived attack from the North. So that if any flag should symbolize slavery and therefore be objectionable today, it should be the first national. But as you said, that's one that, for whatever reason, doesn't have that kind of association. So the answer is, in short, the baggage that the battle flag has acquired in the 150 years since its introduction, it has more to do with its use since the war than it does with its wartime use. And it is sort of counterintuitive, but there you have it, there it is.
Why do you think the battle flag is such a powerful symbol? I mean, is it the shape, the color, the simplicity of it? Is it this symbol that draws you into the center of the flag?
You're certainly correct. The visual, the colors and the shape and simplicity, artist friends of mine have said the same thing, that it's a perfect logo. It's just a logo to die for, because it is so good as a symbol, so effective in drawing attention. So in many ways, it is a victim of its own success as a graphic element. You have to consider that artistic part, artistic dimension to it, that is, in evaluating why it has become the symbol of the Confederacy. One of the points I try to make in my book is that the effort to completely separate the battle flag, which of course began life as a battle flag of what became Lee's Army of Northern Virginia, and it was associated primarily with the soldiers who fought the war, and especially the soldiers in the Eastern Army, on whose efforts and successes the Confederacy depended so much. And it should, in other words, be a soldier's flag. And a lot of people today make the very common sense and apparently sound argument that that flag should be the soldier's flag and should just be exempt from any of the discussions and the debates whatever you think about those debates, about the cause of the war or about the nature of the Confederacy and whether or not it was involved, it was associated with slavery. All that, they can leave those arguments aside. This is a soldier's flag, pure and simple. Well, it's the sort of argument that would solve things if it were true. But the fact is, it isn't true, because if you look at the flags that succeeded the first national flag of the Confederacy, and beginning in May of 1863, it was nothing but a white flag with the battle flag in the upper left-hand corner in the canton. And then the third national flag of the Confederacy that flew during the last months of the war, basically the same flag with a vertical red bar on the fly end, as it's called, of the flag. So in other words, the last 2 years of the war, the Confederacy's national flag, symbolizing the nation, not simply the soldiers anymore, highlighted that blue cross on the red field flag. And the reason they adopted it is because that flag had been consecrated by the victories of the armies, and also that it was the more appropriate flag for a truly independent nation, not a flag that was, as the first national was, a deliberate mimicking of the stars and stripes. So the first national was the right flag during the weaning period, if you would, of Confederate nationalism. But when the Confederate nationalism matured, it needed a mature flag. And the symbol that stood for the Confederate nation at that point was the old blue cross on the red field. So it's not possible to make this clean separation between the national symbol and the soldier's symbol.
In your book, The Confederate Battle Flag, I got the sense that there was this very relatively clear separation of the perception of the flag before the Civil Rights Movement and then after the Civil Rights Movement. What were the attitudes of African Americans toward the battle flag before that Civil Rights Movement and its proliferation among racist groups?
That's a great question, and that clearly is what plays into the debates today. It certainly has a lot to do with the Civil War and the Confederacy and the Confederacy's association with slavery. And that alone would provoke what would make the battle flag, which has become the primary symbol of the Confederacy, it would make that symbol controversial to some degree. But the main reason for the controversy surrounding the battle flag has to do with what's happened in our own time. But long story short, before about late 1940s or so, the battle flag was relatively constricted in its uses. It was basically the property and used almost exclusively by organizations that revered it, and almost exclusively in ways that made sense. There were memorial uses at veterans' parades and reunions and meetings of organizations of descendants of Confederates, at Memorial Day parades and observations of solemn occasions, particularly Memorial Day and Confederate holidays. What happened in the late 1940s was its entry into popular culture, and this is all sort of an indirect way of answering the civil rights question, because it became a symbol of Southern schools playing Northern schools in football. It became a symbol of Southern servicemen serving among servicemen from all over the country in World War II, in Korea. It became not just a Confederate symbol, but a Southern symbol. It was a totem of people who wanted to identify themselves as Southerners, and in their hands, it also became a symbol of rebellion, of the personal quality of being a rebel. So it took on more generic meanings, and this apparently happened through Confederate heritage movements, heritage organizations, particularly Kappa Alpha fraternity, at colleges and universities. So it went from being a symbol of heritage to a symbol of hijinks, if you will, of youthful hijinks. All the while, the Confederate heritage organizations were trying to keep a lid on that kind of thing, because they recognized a fundamental truth that the more widely it is used, the more carelessly it is used, the more likely these groups are to lose control of it and its meaning, that they would no longer have ownership over it and be able to determine what it means more generally. And that, of course, is exactly what has happened. Enter now the Civil Rights Movement, the Brown decision occurred just a couple of years after the national media gave wide coverage to something they called the flag fad. That was a nationwide flag fad of people It was akin to hula hoops and coonskin caps, youthful fads of the late 1940s and 50s. So that symbol was sort of in the air in the late 40s and 50s, and was adopted first by the Dixiecrat Party, by youthful supporters anyway, mostly college kids, who were already accustomed to having it on campus, and they took it to the convention of the States Rights Party in Birmingham, Alabama in 1948, and they were captured by the cameras, by the world media. Here's a secessionist movement in the Democratic Party, a States Rights Party based very clearly on resistance to civil rights, and there's this battle flag. Well, what happened the last time the South seceded? What was their symbol? This battle flag, and now the South is seceding again from the Democratic Party, and once again they turn to this symbol. So it immediately in 1948 launched that symbol into the national consciousness as a symbol of Southern rebellion and defense of segregation, and thus resistance to integration and civil rights. And it became worse with when the Klan began using it more generally in the 1950s after the Brown decision. That was a game changer. One of the effects of it that's been kind of subtle, but I think very important, is that the groups that first reacted against the youthful adoption of the flag by saying, kids, put that flag away, that's not a good use of that flag, this is a sacred symbol, it should only be used on sacred occasions. Those groups, some of them anyway, compromised that sort of very strict definition of what proper use of the flag was, and they started defending the use of the flag and, in fact, promoting it in direct proportion to how African Americans were saying, put it away. In other words, they sort of changed their terms in reaction to African Americans' objections to the flag.
As you researched your book and addressed the various controversies that have occurred around the Southeast over the last 50, 60 years, have you noticed any kind of pattern to these situations? Is there a certain way that they tend to play out?
There is. They occur mostly on the local level at schools and the like. There are First Amendment cases where kids wear T-shirts to schools and they get maybe suspended, and then the ACLU and other organizations intervene to help to defend their First Amendment rights to display their symbols on their clothing or on their notebooks or whatever else. And schools are kind of different from other places. But those are the run-of-the-mill, the so-called T-shirt cases. The ones you're referring to are the big ones on the state-level cases, the flags over the domes of Alabama and South Carolina, and on the state flags of Georgia, formerly, and still Mississippi. They tend to be polarizing and polarized. But yet most people in those states and involved in these issues are somewhere in the middle, but yet there's a kind of dynamic that tends to polarize it and make it seem that everyone is at each other's throats and they're completely incompatible viewpoints. But most people tend to have a kind of common sense attitude toward flags. They can make the distinction between the right to fly it on one's own property and the flying on the state house, for example. Or you can put it on your car, but it shouldn't be on the state flag, that kind of thing. So there's a dynamic, and as we were talking about earlier, the first national flag, the Stars and Bars, is often suggested as an alternative, a kind of how to have a Confederate flag without having a Confederate flag that offends people because it doesn't have the baggage of the battle flag. Mm-hmm. That usually enters into the course of the debate as well.
Well, getting back to I guess a culturalization of the Confederate battle flag. Are we ever going to get to a point where it largely, I don't know that it ever will completely, but it largely sheds that baggage?
Darn good question. I would have thought, my book appeared 7 years ago now, and I thought that after the Georgia state flag was finally sort of settled, although some people would say it's not settled yet, that things would settle down for a while. And I think they kind of have. But they seem to go in cycles. I mean, they're in the immediate aftermath of the civil rights movement, and as African Americans were getting a voice in local politics, and they were in a position to have a voice about those flags. Those flags that had been put up around the southern landscape on stores and on courthouses and on official and unofficial places, street names and the like. They really hadn't had a significant role in determining whether or not that was proper. And once they got their voice, they protested against it in the late 1960s and into the 1970s. And then the issue died out again until the NAACP raised the issue again on a regional level in the Southeast in late 1987, 88. And that set off another wave that really extended until the resolution of the Georgia flag issue in 2004, I guess it was. And then it sort of died back again. But what's happening in Paducah is part of a, I won't say a new pattern, but a continued pattern that has played out around the nation. There have been flags put on private property on in prominent locations over interstates in Georgia and in Florida along I-95, and on private property in a similar memorial park in Point Lookout, Maryland, after a court decision forbade the use of the flying of the flag around the clock at Point Lookout proper. So that seems to be part of a pattern, a kind of pushback, if you will, to display the flag prominently. And then that pushback, in turn, has evokes a predictable response, and there we go. Here we go again, round in circles.
Well, I think it probably goes without saying that the battle flag is always going to be a part of local and certainly regional culture. My last question is, do you think that there's a place for the Confederate battle flag among our national symbols?
What I've written, and I guess I would still think this is a rational answer 7 years later, is that, well, I mean, I think I agree with you on the inevitability of it. It is, as I refer to it in the book, the second American flag that goes back to or speaks to the simple, undeniable fact that, and it's subtle, and yet we don't look at it very often, that the people who fought against the national authority in 1861-65 were allowed back into the nation. They weren't executed. They weren't forced into re-education camps. Reconstruction did not involve requiring people to forsake their culture, their dead, their heroes. In fact, quite the opposite. They've been allowed over the century to erect statues to the dead and to have the symbols that meant something to them when they were in defiance of the federal government, which is pretty darned unique. But that century of allowance, of toleration of the symbols of a defeated rebel nation has laid the groundwork for that flag being part of our popular culture, and to purge it from the culture is almost impossible, and it's asking a lot of the people who for whom it means a lot. The question is whether the flag can take a place that what I write in the book is as an unambiguous historical or memorial symbol, and trying to apply common sense as well as civility, really, to questions like this, to try to find a place that doesn't make it speak for people who don't want it to speak for them, thus not on places, on public property, on courthouses, on state symbols that that symbolize people who don't revere it, but finding a sort of a safe haven as a historical symbol that simply means as objectively as you can make it that the Confederacy was here too, that the Confederacy was its simple recognition of the fact of the Confederacy as an important part of American history. Or here lie the graves of those men who fought and died under this flag. And whatever you might think of the cause for which they fought, this was their symbol and here they are. It seems to me that's the proper place, is when it, as an historical symbol, a memorial symbol that doesn't try to represent or speak for all the people in a given entity, and one that doesn't confuse the past and the present. Anytime that flag seems to symbolize the South will rise again, or should rise again, or that the Confederacy never died, they're simply an armistice and the war goes on. If it is ever displayed in that kind of context, there's obviously going to be a problem. I mean, common sense tells you that.
John Koski is the author of The Confederate Battle Flag, America's Embattled Emblem. He's also a historian at the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Seth Helton, Casey Northcutt, Gary Pitts, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance.
If you have questions or comments about the stories you've heard today, You can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say at our Facebook page, and there's a link to that page at our website, news.wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Join us Friday morning at 8:35 for Front Page AM and Friday evening at 6:30 for Front Page PM. Thanks for being with us.